And now, live from Sharp Facets Gallery, it's time for the I Love Ann Show.
Yeah, that's right. We're right here on WCRS 1450 AM. Certainly hope you're enjoying the show here this morning. I am Ann Eller. We just had Congressman Tim Scott on with us. Now we have one of our state legislators right here. We have Representative Mike Pitts from over there in Lawrence. How you doing today, Mike Pitts?
I'm doing great. I'm here with you.
You're not down in Columbia, right?
That's correct. And when I leave here, I'm going to pick up the grandbaby, and we're planting a flower garden. So I'm doing very well today.
Well, gosh, at least you have a beautiful day to do it, huh?
That's right. As long as I cover this head up, or we'll have a good burn.
Absolutely. Well, gee, Mike, how has it been really this first, well, I guess we could call it first quarter, down there in Columbia? You know, you're on the House Ways and Means, and of course you get all these issues coming right to your door. How's it been this first term?
It's been harder for me this particular year than any two other years since I've been there combined.
Why is that?
Well, I chair a budget subcommittee, and we have begun to look at things a little differently, and I started meeting with my committee in November, the 1st of November, as opposed to early January this year. Plus, I was serving on the retirement committee at the same time that was meeting all during the interim between last session and this session, and I serve on the newly founded Other Funds Oversight Committee, which is a joint committee between the Senate and House. So I had three different sets of numbers going through this little small computer chip I call a brain at one time, and it was difficult. It's been stressful. One of the other guys that served on the committee, all those committees with me, there are three of us that actually serve on all those committees. And
that's interesting that three people would serve on all three of those committees, isn't it?
It is. And I told Jimmy Merrill was one of the other ones, and Jimmy and I were talking on the floor this past week, and when we finished the retirement bill, Jimmy looked at me and said, I feel like a weight has just been lifted off my shoulders. And I said, I know exactly how you feel. We presented our budget. We've got it, gotten it out of the way. We've done the retirement bill. We've gotten it out of the way. And the Oversight Committee now has, instead of 20 to 30 agencies coming before us trying to circumvent the system, in most cases, we now have three or four coming before us at a time for legitimate reasons.
Well, how did you feel about what the retirement bill going through? How did you feel about that, Mike?
I felt that we did the best that we could do, considering the circumstances. I think we put a very good bill out to the floor, and it was debated heavily on the floor and passed out with a solid number and votes from both sides of the aisle. So I think we did the best we could do. And then on the budget, it was a unanimous vote on second and third reading. And
Does that ever happen?
I think it's happened once in the 10 years that I've been there, and that was on a third reading. I don't recall it ever happening that we had a unanimous vote on second and third reading of the budget.
So does that mean y'all are working and playing nice together?
It means the kids in the sandbox playing well together. When you have Jimmy Merrill, Mike Pitts, Gilda Cobb Hunter, and Harry Ott voting all together on one issue, somebody's done the work well.
You know, I think that's the way government was always intended to work.
Well, I don't know that a unanimous vote on final reading is the way it's always been intended to work. But working through an issue with give and take and reaching a final product that neither one is completely happy with but we can all live with is the
sure.
way government works.
I know. And you know, when we look at Congress and the Senate up there, it just seems like we've been at such a standstill.
Well, in Congress, the issues are so polar opposite, or place people in such polar opposite directions, that compromises become very difficult. And when you see some of the actions that were taken by Pelosi and Reid when they had absolute control, they had total disregard for the other side of the aisle, and that leads to a lot of bad blood.
It does, but they haven't learned how to play nice when things changed a little bit, have they?
No, they haven't. And the pendulum always swings the other way. It may take a while, but it always swings the other way. And right now, we have a huge majority in the, of Republicans in the House in Columbia. That won't always be the case.
Sure.
Sooner or later, the pendulum will start going in the other direction. So it pays to work well together.
Absolutely. Now, you have a lot that are, of course, you're up for re-election. I guess really everybody is, aren't they?
Yes. The House is up every election, gubernatorial or presidential, and the Senate's up during presidential. So, yes, all 170 members of us are up for re-election this year.
How's that creating the feeling down there? And, you know, there's going to be a lot of stress with people knowing not only that they need to do a good job, but that they're got to watch their backs because they've got an election coming up.
It makes it very difficult. And you have extremes out here now in groups that had not been there in the past, and it makes it difficult, too. Plus, a good part of that, a good side of the equation is, with the internet and a lot of other things, you have much more oversight of what the General Assembly is doing. Your votes are now open to the public, and that's a good thing. It's not necessarily a bad thing. I've never minded my votes being public. I can defend my record. I have an opponent this year, and I will be running on my record. And either the people will say I've done a good job and send me back, or they'll send me home.
It's actually kind of nice to have a straight-up, straight-down decision, though, isn't it?
It is for me.
Yeah, that's what I mean, you know?
Yes.
Yeah. I've always liked straight-up, straight-down, give me the answer, don't give me the gobbledygook, give me the answer.
Well, I was told this past week by the press that in Columbia that's why they enter my door all the time is because I give them straight answers. And generally, it's a one-line soundbite.
There you go, a one-line soundbite. Well, we're going to have a lot more time with Mike this morning. We're not looking for one-liners here this morning. We're looking for a conversation. If you'd like to give us a call, Telephone Man is here, 229-7984. That's 229-7984. Give us a call. We'll be right back. We're going to hear a word from our sponsors, so don't you go away.
Gold, more precious than any other time in history. Do you have gold? Do you need cash? Then bring it to SFG. That's Sharp Facets Gallery, 1220 Bypass 72, Greenwood. Telephone 229-6613. Don't forget, we buy diamonds too. Paying the highest prices for your gold and diamonds at Sharp Facets Gallery.
It's time for the I Love Ann Show.
We are back here at Sharp Passes Gallery. We do have Representative Mike Pitts. He's on a two-week hallelujah furlough here, I guess you could say. Easter happens to fall in between it, but still has 2 weeks off. You know, it's got to be hard being in the position of a representative or a senator because you really spend the first half of the year taking care of business. And as you were talking about, you even met a lot in November and when you weren't really in session. For those that have to have another job, that's got to be tough.
It's extremely tough. And a lot of this past election, we had several young guys come into the General Assembly, young guys being 25 or less. And they found that it was very difficult to live a life that they wanted to live, serving the General Assembly and make a living.
Yeah, because how can you be at a job when you've got to spend 4 days down there in Columbia?
You can't. I had a young fellow run against me the last election, and he came to my office and we met, and that was a question I asked him. Is your company gonna let you off
right
3 days a week to serve and time to attend all the meetings and stuff you have to do when you're not in Columbia? And he said, I don't think so. And my second question was, can you make a living on $10,400 a year? No.
No, the answer is no, absolutely. So that has to be tough. Now, we wanted to talk a little bit about school choice. That bill was up last week. What can you tell us about that, Mike?
It passed the House and is now in the Senate for the first time. The bill actually passed the House and went to the Senate. And that is an issue that's been debated for the 10 years I've been in the General Assembly.
Now, what in essence is the school choice bill?
Well, it originally started as put parents in charge, and it was basically a voucher bill at that time. Now, Harry Stilley, former legislator from Abbeville, was a strong proponent at that time, and his argument was very simple. The GI Bill is the most clear school choice bill you could have. GIs came back from World War II. They were told, go to school, and here's the amount you have to spend. And they chose any school they wanted to and went to
school. No questions asked.
No questions asked. And it worked very well for them. Currently, the school choice bill that came through the House has two major components. One is it's a tax deduction. It's no longer a voucher bill. It's no longer a credit bill.
So you don't get any money for sending your child to a different school system.
That's correct. It is very simple. It is a tax deduction. And it's just like any other deduction that you have when you fill out your taxes on state level, whether it is home loan, student loan, or whatever it is that you can deduct off your taxes, it would be the same type deduction.
Is it a bit more watered down then? Do people feel that it's not as useful?
Yes, it is more watered down from a purist standpoint, but I firmly believe in the tax deduction anyway. And when I ran originally, that was one of the things that I talked about. It's one of the things that I was looking at was a tax deduction. And the reason was a huge number of working class families are the ones that send their kids to private schools. Everyone thinks it's the rich people of the world, and they probably do. But working class families are the ones that choose quite often to send their kids to a private school. And it's a burden on them. It's a huge burden. And people can say it's public money going to private schools with a tax bill. But those same parents are paying taxes at the same time that they are paying tuition. This doesn't give them all their tax money back. It simply gives them a tax deduction.
More like an offset.
More like an offset. And homeschoolers. Homeschoolers get no support. So it's good in that regard. The other thing it does is it gave it would have structured a foundation that could have taken private donation from industry and targeted that toward scholarships and both private and public school.
And so do we feel that this is going to go through the Senate, that it's going to pass the Senate?
I doubt it.
You doubt it?
The Senate is, they still have the budget in front of them. The retirement bill is in front of them, and that's what we've spent since we started in the second Tuesday of January to just this past week dealing with was the budget and the retirement bill. And with that in front of them and it being an election year for the Senate, which slows down an already slow body, I don't see very much that has any contention to it happening.
Wow. So that one's maybe dead there for a while, huh?
I think it will be. I don't see that even getting on the calendar in the Senate before the end of this session.
Wow. Now, what about since we're on schools, what about the school bus issue? Well, I had to ask you a tough one here.
It's according to who you're talking to in Columbia. There are a variety of things. I personally think that we should look at privatization of parts of it, and I think it should go back to the local level. But I also, in the same vein, certainly do not think that we need to hand our local school districts a dilapidated bus fleet and tell them it's now yours running. The state has not, in my opinion, the state has not done its job of keeping the bus fleet up to standard, and if we were going to turn it over, the first thing we should do is bring that bus fleet up to standard. And
are you saying we don't have good buses and we're transporting our children on them?
I'm saying that a lot of the buses are old. They it's like the firefighting equipment that the state has in the forestry. It's old and it needs to be replaced.
How would they go about doing that, though? Do we have the money to do that? I know the lottery helps out with some aspects of the school buses. But how would we go about doing it? Would we just have to find the money?
You just have to make a priority decision and say this is what we're doing this year. And I referred to or referenced the equipment for the Division of Forestry, and we did that this year. We put money on the table to bring our firefighting equipment for our forestry up to standard, and that money left a gap somewhere else to put that much money into it. But I'll tell you where that came from. I supported that 100% and would do so again. When a couple of years ago, you had a fire in Horry County. Mm-hmm. If two things had not happened, Myrtle Beach would have burned to the ground.
Okay.
And there was a strong wind blowing and fanning the flames coming through northern Horry County, headed straight toward the beach. And our folks had to call on North Carolina to come down and help us. And North Carolina luckily did not have a major forest fire of their own at that time and were able to come down and assist. And God granted us a wish and a prayer and shifted the winds to blowing toward the coast to away from the coast and pushed flames back into themselves. Those two things combined kept Myrtle Beach from burning.
Are you saying that North Carolina has better equipment than we do?
I'm saying North Carolina had better equipment than us. But
Where did money have to be taken out of, Mike?
It didn't have to be taken from anywhere else. We just had to make a priority decision that this is where we're placing surplus revenue this year. That surplus revenue could have gone to 1,000 other places and been very much used.
Was that a tough decision? Because I would think a lot of people would say, we've got enough. They can fight the fires.
It was a tough decision, and I helped the chairman of that subcommittee work that issue. And I served on that subcommittee before I took the chair of the law enforcement subcommittee. And just prior to the fire in Myrtle Beach, I asked Gene Kadama, who is the head of our forestry division, during the budget hearing, if we had a fire like North Carolina had at that particular time, mm-hmm. they had a major fire in western North Carolina, I said, could we fight the fire? And he looked at me and didn't want to answer. I said, Gene, I'm asking you a serious question, and I need a straight and honest answer. And he said, no, we could not. He said, we have the personnel, and we have good people, but our equipment breaks down on a regular basis, and I fear for the safety of our firefighters. And less than 2 weeks after that meeting is when the fire occurred in South Carolina. And I told that story over and over for mm-hmm. people to hear, that firefighter's he's much different in the effect that he's by himself most often.
Right.
He's driving a dozer or a piece of equipment through a forest, probably at night, pushing through trying to put fire breaks in. And if that equipment breaks down, he's got a serious issue, especially if it's old equipment and is not does not have the contained cab that would keep him safe if the fire came over him.
Absolutely. You know, and particularly with all the fires that we've seen in the Midwest and the West, I mean, just phenomenal type stuff and the fastness that these fires can move.
Well, with the weather we've had, with no winter and drier conditions for the last few years, the forest fire season is extended longer and longer each year.
Now, you said something very interesting with the surplus funds. Are you saying we got more money down there?
I'm saying we did.
Okay.
We had somewhere around $900 million in undedicated revenue this year. And
do we still have any of that?
No, we don't.
Yeah.
Well, yes, we do. We put a good bit of it in reserve funds, and we increased the reserve fund. The reserve fund in the past was at 3%. We increased that to 5%. So we did increase our reserve funds, and some of it is still there. We also put $180 million to the side for
rainy day fund or
for the Savannah River issue
issue
which is another issue altogether. And and then the bulk of the rest of it went to three places. It went to health care, it went to education, and it went to law enforcement. I fought hard to get some of that money into law enforcement because they had been put on the back burner for the last 4 years.
Absolutely. Well, we are here with Mike Pitts. That's right, Representative Mike Pitts. Always one of my favorite people to talk to from down there at the in Columbia. And, of course, he lives right over there in Lawrence. We're going to hear a word from South Carolina News and then a word from our sponsors. So I certainly hope you'll stay right with us. Hey, if you've got a question early in the morning here, give us a call, 229-7984. That's 229-7984. We'll be right back with Mike Pitts after the news.
What does WLMA stand for? Well, it stands for Wow, Let's Meet Again, right here on 1350 AM, Greenwood and the Lakelands News Talk radio station.
And now, live from Sharp Facets Gallery, it's time for the I Love Ann Show.
Oh, that's right. We are right back here at Sharp Facets Gallery. We are talking with the one and only Mike Pitts here this morning, having a, wow, fascinating conversation. We're going to share some of this conversation with you when we get a little further into things. But, you know, we were talking about the school buses and the condition of the school buses, which is kind of frightening when we're talking about sending our children to school on school buses, that you said they needed to be in good shape before they were turned over if that was something that was going to happen. Would that be a good summary of what we just talked about?
That would be a very good summary of what we just talked about. I think there are parts of the bus system that could be privatized. I would not want to privatize the entire thing.
Okay.
I think that for disciplinary reasons, the school should still have some control over the school buses.
Well, you know, like, it certainly is different today. I remember growing up, the only way you went to school was on a school bus. You know, everybody rode the school bus. And today, you know, I don't know how many kids ride the school bus, but there's a whole lot of people being dropped off and picked up at every school.
And if you ride by the high school, you see a whole lot of students pull up in a single car and get out.
Yeah. So it certainly has changed the way the school buses were used. But then we wanted to talk a little bit about roads and bridges. You know, our roads and bridges are getting in pretty darn bad shape here, and I understand that the money goes, we pay taxes, it goes to the federal government, and then it's supposed to come back to us, correct?
That's correct.
What's happening?
Well, we are what's known as a donor state.
A donor?
Yep. That's one of the things that ends up being a negative for us, is we send more money than we get back.
And why is that?
It's the formula set up by the federal government.
Okay, but if you sent the taxes there and you need them, they should come back.
I agree with that 100%.
So how do you make that change?
Well, the same way I've tried to make change in several other things contested on the 10th Amendment. But right now, our very good and capable Attorney General, Alan Wilson, is doing battle on two issues already on states' rights, and probably has one, at least one, and possibly two more on the horizon. South Carolina is in the middle of a contest over states' rights issue with the federal government in federal district court on
immigration
and health care. So we are one of the states involved in both of those issues. That, which is an interesting one. And I put a bill in 08 called the South Carolina Immigration Act of 08. And that was exactly what I was trying to do at that point, was fire up a contest over 10th Amendment with the federal government. And my statement was very simple. They are not doing their job by controlling our borders. They are creating the problem, or allowing the problem to be created. It's affecting the state. It's affecting the state's budget. So one of two things either needs to happen. They either need to do their job and leave us alone, or they need to leave us alone and let us do the job that they're supposed to be doing, and they pay for it. And I could not get the bill out of subcommittee in the House Judiciary, and Chairman Harrison told me it's very simple. It's a constitutional issue. It's going to create constitutional conflict. I said, I know. That's exactly what I'm trying to do. The immigration bill that I wrote had a component on education and a component on health care, and a component on the Second Amendment, all three of which were targeted to create constitutional conflict and resolution through the court.
Well, I think it'll be real interesting to see. But, of course, that costs money, doesn't it, to put those challenges up there?
Yes, it does.
And I understand that we have one of the best out there on the immigration. Actually, one of the same guys who was prosecuting on the health care.
That's correct.
That's correct. That's right. I talked to State's Attorney Alan Wilson last week. I'm anxious. We're actually going to be talking to him tomorrow. He told me that he felt like he had gotten the golden ticket to the Willy Wonka Chocolate Factory to be able to be in the courtroom while this whole thing was going on at the Supreme Court. So I'll be interested to hear what he has to say.
I agree with him. He's not just an observer. He's a participant.
Absolutely. So the immigration, now, do you have any idea when that's going to be coming up yet?
No,
haven't set that up yet.
See, that's a different one. The states are not suing on that one. The federal government is suing the states on that one.
Okay, so we have to defend ourselves, is what we're saying.
That's correct. Arizona's defending it, and other states are involved in the lawsuit because we also have immigration bills that are being taken to task. Alabama, South Carolina.
You know, yesterday I was watching some of the Sunday morning shows that I always like to watch, and one of the things that they were saying is that the federal government cannot afford to deport illegals. They cannot, and they do not have the beds for the illegals.
And when I was a police officer in the small town of Woodruff, back in the 70s, early 80s, we had immigrant workers that were working in the peach orchards and the apple orchards.
Mm-hmm.
And one night, one of the other officers stopped a car that had several Hispanics in it that were migrant workers. And none of them had a green card. None of them had a driver's license. So that officer called me in to ask what to do with them. And I said, well, let's call immigration in Atlanta and see if we can find out. When we finally got in touch with an immigration officer in Atlanta, we were advised, are they violent? No. Turn them loose. We don't have the capability of dealing with it.
Right.
He said, we don't have the ability to take them back.
And that was when? In the early 80s?
In the early 80s. He told us, if you have more than 100,
Give us a call.
We can deal with that. But it's not cost effective for us to deal with 8 or 10 people.
I think immigration is going to come around to another round for this election. What do you think, Mike?
I think absolutely, because the issue's still there. The problem's still there. You know, immigration is not the issue, Ann. It's illegal immigration, and that's what huge part of the debate is. That one term is something that gets lost in the shuffle. It becomes a political football and a battle, but the term illegal's not even in the mix. My daughter-in-law is Colombian by birth, not Columbia, South Carolina.
Okay.
Columbia, South America. So my grandson, the only grandson that I have, is half immigrant.
Right.
And that young lady came here, it took her 10 years to gain citizenship. She came here and did it the proper way. And when she took the citizenship test, it was funny. She knew the answer, but to her it was the star-splatted banner.
Star-spangled banner,
yes,
right.
That was the answer to one of the questions, and it was the star-splattered banner. But when she was granted citizenship, she cried like a child, and she worked diligently and long to make that happen. That's the process. We need to streamline that process. Someone that's willing to work that hard to become a legal citizen of this country, we should have a process that helps those folks, and we should have a process in place that stops the illegal immigration into our nation.
And we should be able to, the federal government should put the money aside to be able to handle illegal immigration.
I think they should be putting a lot of the money to the side to do that with that they're sending out in foreign aid.
So what do you think about foreign aid? We should be, what do you think, Afghanistan? Iraq we're basically out of, but Afghanistan?
I think that's a never-ending conflict. I think that conflict will go on as long as we're willing to stay there. And that the conflict in the Middle East is a conflict that's gone on since a birthright was stolen in the Old Testament.
Right.
And it's not going to change. If you are a believer, which I am, we know when that conflict's going to end, and it will be Armageddon and a second coming.
So are we wasting time and money?
I don't think we're wasting time combating terrorism.
Okay.
I think there's another way to do it. I think, personally, that the pattern set by the Mossad is the way to go after terrorists.
Meaning?
Meaning you identify and eliminate. And not.
We used to be much stronger on our military side as far as doing things. Don't you agree?
Well, people make the decision. People in policy making positions make decisions now based on how's this going to look in the press, instead of making decisions based on what's best.
Do you think we have too? I think we do have too much media exposure on things that should be not handled that way. I mean, we have them sitting right there when things are happening, and everything, every little bit is reported.
We should never have had live TV embedded with troops on the front line. That should never occur. There are some things that you just don't need to see on TV.
I agree with that.
And the press, in its current form, can put our soldiers and our dignitaries' lives in danger. And law enforcement. I've seen it happen in law enforcement where slanted reporting or real-time reporting mm-hmm. can put people in a dangerous situation. And I'll use one that's not even from our country. I'll use a prince from England who was fighting in the Gulf War.
Mm-hmm.
And the press found out that he was there.
They pulled
and
him
had
out.
To tell the world.
Yes.
Well, what did the world gain by knowing that Prince Harry was in the middle of a firefight in Afghanistan?
And they ended up pulling him out because they were feared for his life.
They had to, because then he becomes a major target for the enemy.
Don't you think all the information that goes out there is just as good for the enemy? They're helping the enemy in a lot of aspects, aren't they?
They are. What do you think World War II would have been like had Harry Truman or Roosevelt and then Truman had to make decisions based on the press being in the middle of it at all times? What about the D-Day invasion? I can see some of the newscasters now, the D-Day invasion set to go off in the morning at 0600 hours.
And they were reporting it at 3 that it was going to happen at 6.
That's right.
Exactly.
So Hitler and be prepared, here we come.
Yeah.
You can't do that. That's not realistic.
I agree with you 100%. So, but I want to get to this other topic that you had told me about. Actually, we have two that I'd like to talk about. But you said this is one that's kind of under the current, ha ha ha, zoning the ocean, the marine spatial planning. What is this all about? You said this is really going to affect us very big.
It can affect us very, very big, according to how it goes. Marine spatial planning is simply zoning of the ocean. If you picture, picture, if you will, your Greenwood County zoning board.
Mm-hmm.
Sitting down and looking at a coordinates map of the ocean and zoning it.
We don't have that right now, do we?
No, we don't. It would be, well, you do, but not on the East Coast. You have certain parts that already have been zoned off the West Coast.
Now, the states own three miles out. Is that correct? State, and then the federal government takes over?
States' waters go up to 3 miles out from the shore, and the federal government picks up there and goes out to international waters. And zoning, again, looking at what your local zoning board would do, commercial goes here, residential goes here, and that's the way it's set up.
Multi-housing and all this kind of stuff.
Correct.
Right?
Does it give you an ability to plan? Absolutely. And here's the way it's sold by the federal government. We need to have the ocean mapped. I agree. We need to have planning. I agree to some degree. But then comes the devil in the details. Section 21 will be zoned for oil drilling. Section 22 will be domestic fishermen. And
charter boats and that
charter
type of
boats
things,
and Section 1 will be for surfers.
Okay.
Well, the best water to surf may be in Zone 2. The best area for recreational fishing in Zone 3.
And more importantly, the one you're going for now.
And no oil in Zone 26, but there is in Zone 4, 7, 8, and 9.
And they've outlawed the ability to do that, literally.
So, by zoning and regulating the usage of those areas of the ocean, they prohibit certain things from being done, period, without all the legislative process that needs to take place.
And the federal government would be doing this rather than the states?
That's correct. It gives them the ability to encroach into those 3 miles of water that belong to the states. Another states' rights issue that the federal government is getting all into. The direction of our federal government is taking us to centralized government operating out of Washington, which is what I've seen in South America and Europe. I don't like it very much. It also, the slant is directly toward a one-world government. When you see Hillary Clinton wanting to sign international gun bans,
that affects us too, doesn't
that
it?
That affects us. And it goes into direct conflict with the Second Amendment to our Constitution. There seems to be an absolute ignorance of the Constitution in some areas. Now, the debate, this bill, the Marine Spatial Planning Bill, I pushed one through the House. It is now in the Senate and is being taken up and pushed by Senator Chip Campson from Charleston. And what it says is very simple. South Carolina is not going to let happen to us what happened to California and Hawaii. We want to be a part. Don't do it and then dictate to us what's going to happen, or you're not going to utilize our resources to do it. And here's what that means. In the past, they've had the state's Department of Natural Resources and Department of Health and Environmental do all of the mapping and zoning and the sciences, and then they do what they want to do with it. So what we have said through the bill that I pushed was either we are part of the decision making or we are not going to provide resources to do it.
And do you think it should be so cut and dried as far as zoning even?
Well, And again, I allude back to the pattern that was set in Hawaii and the pattern that was set off the coast of California, and it was very cut and dried. And the end result was two things. It affected two industries specifically. One was oil, the other was recreational fishermen. Now the irony in that, Ann, is let's say Zone 3, for instance, is off limits to recreational fishing. And the reason they say that is the mom and dad and three kids that charter a boat in Charleston and go out and fish for black sea bass today are hurting the population.
Are they?
Well,
how many fish are they going to catch?
Not very many on most days. Some days they don't catch any. But the fallacy of it is if it's protection of the species we're looking at, they're not setting the limits off to commercial fishermen. And recreational fishermen, by all estimates, take less than 3% of the total catch of fish, somewhere about 1.5% of the total catch of fish. So if you really want, if that's your real agenda, is to protect species, then people dragging nets behind the boat are the ones you should be taking a look at. Now, are they both creating a depletion of the species? In some instances, they could be, and the issue there is creel limits and catch limits, and not a total shutting down of fishing, especially to the recreational fishermen.
Well, this sounds like to me that this is something that's like a first step, isn't it? Then pretty soon we get to the beach itself, and then do we keep going further in?
Well, the international policy that this current administration is trying to be a part of would give it control of the Great Lakes and control of the major tributaries. And in the long run, the only thing that wouldn't be a part of it would be any that's not a free-flowing stream, which would be a catch pond for a farm somewhere.
Wow, that's huge.
It is huge.
That is huge. And that's something we haven't really heard that much about. Now, I understand you were talking to Congressman Jeff Duncan, and that's something that he's actually working with.
Congressman Duncan serves on the Wildlife Committee in Congress, and yes, that's the NOAA and the Marine Spatial Planning issue is one that they're also looking at. So my old seatmate and I have been comparing notes on what's happening in Washington and what we're trying to do to circumvent some of it on the state level. And, you know, during this debate, I was told, you're just attacking the Obama administration. And I said, nope, this started under the Clinton administration, carried through the Bush administration, and is being exacerbated by the Obama administration. He took the groundwork and is running with it, basically.
Well, I think it's got to be very interesting, the fact that Congressman Jeff Duncan is up there and you're able to compare notes. That's got to be a nice in to be able to find out what's going on.
It is, and Jeff and I, we are in constant contact, but the last 3 or 4 weeks we've not been on a daily basis like we normally are because of his agenda and his schedule and my schedule. But when we started comparing notes, and there was very little difference in the way we were thinking. I didn't find any difference in the way we were thinking and our approaches to it. So not much has changed for Congressman Duncan since he went to Washington. It's not changed him.
So he hasn't been drinking the water up there?
I would say the Kool-Aid's not in his cup.
Well, we hope to be talking to him sometime this week or next week and be able to get an update on him. I'll be sure to ask him about that. We only have a couple minutes left. Any other issues you'd like to address, Mike?
Yes, I have a campaign coming up this year.
Yes, you do.
As a matter of fact, all 170 members of the General Assembly are up for election this year, and I will have a contested race this year. So anyone that is out there listening, I would appreciate your support.
Absolutely. And you are very reachable, and that is one thing I like about you, Mike Pitts. You can people have questions, they want to know what's going on, you're always telling them what's happening.
That's kind of funny because I answer my own phone. Even when Barbara's sitting at her desk, if the phone rings, I will answer it if I'm not busy doing something else. And people always say, I didn't expect you to answer your own phone, but that's just the way I operate, and it's hands-on.
Absolutely. And we do need to mention, you know, I had Gene Pinson on last week, and he was telling us about the Barbara and people like that, that really you only have a real part-time staff. The work really comes down to you when it comes to getting the job done.
It does, and the Senate has full-time staff. In the House, we share one legislative aide for the staff, which is basically our secretary, and she's only there when we are there. 3 days a week in Columbia. In session, when we're not in session, we don't have staff at all. So, yes, we end up having to do a lot of our own work.
Well, that makes you more hands-on here. Say, listen, I have one more question I want to ask you. We are right here at the top of the hour, so if we can just give the idea, I'm going to ask you one more question here. Well, I might ask two. But since I've got you here, sitting here, we're going to finish up here. This is WCRS right here in Greenwood. You know, one of the other issues that's out there is the dredging of the Savannah River.
That's correct.
And Governor Nikki Haley vetoed it, and now where is it at?
Well, that one's headed to court. It's going to be a battle between us being South Carolina and Georgia over the dredging issue. And we've got to protect the Charleston Harbor, or it's a major detriment to the state of South Carolina economically. And the upstate does not understand to a great degree why some of us especially, are very involved in that fight. And it's simple. BMW, Michelin, and Fuji, and anyone else that transports major products out of the upstate transport it internationally through the port of Charleston.
What would that mean if the veto stands? What would this mean, Mike?
It would mean that Savannah, Georgia, would deepen their harbor, and every export that we send out of the state of South Carolina would have to go through Savannah as opposed to Charleston. And I-26 runs directly from the upstate to Charleston. So what that means is one of two things. The companies would either have to spend more to get their product to market, or they would move closer to Savannah, Georgia.
That's not good for us.
Neither one are.
Absolutely. You know, it's kind of hard for me to believe why that came about. Why wouldn't we want to deepen our own harbor?
She stated environmental reasons, but if it's environmental reasons, that's the first time I've seen her fall on the side of green as opposed to the side of business.
Absolutely. So this is a hard one to figure out, of course, so that's going to be another fight coming up. Any idea when that will be coming up?
It's on the burner right now. Alan Wilson's already started the preliminary fights in that and has already testified. The proper process was not followed in this by the governor's office. Alan told me that himself. It was DHEC was circumvented, DNR was circumvented, and the decision was made without the input of our scientist or our biologist.
So this will be one to watch, folks. One thing we do definitely want, we've been talking about deepening this harbor for how long?
Since I've been in the General Assembly.
And now more than ever, it's important because we're going to have those big ships coming around. This has been a fight going on and should not be derailed.
Well, I've worked very closely with the environmental community on a major of issues. Water quality is very important to my district because of Lake Greenwood, Lake Raven, et cetera, the Saluda River, the Reedy River. But with all that in mind, I've worked very closely with the environmental community and the lobbyists in Columbia, so I know the issues. And this is not one that pits the environmental community directly against the business community. This is one that can be worked by both sides to good compromise and still achieve the goal of a deepened harbor that we can get our the ships of the future into. This is a contest. It's either going to be South Carolina that wins or Georgia that wins, and we had the upper hand.
Had the upper hand. Well, folks, this is going to be one to watch, and, you know, you need to get out there and support the fact that this affects not only the port of Charleston, but affects, as you said, the upper state, because how are we going to move the goods in and out?
Well, a lot of manufacturing, a great deal of the state's manufacturing is done in the upstate and shipped to the coast.
So there you go. This is an important issue. You may not have known that much about it, but now, thank you very much, Mike Pitts, for making it crystal clear.
Well, I hope I didn't muddy the water too much.
You didn't. You actually made it crystal clear for me. I haven't understood what was going on. Hey, I am Ann Eller right here on WCRS 1450 AM. Congressman someday maybe, but State Representative Mike Pitts, thanks so much for coming here today.
Thank you for having me, and any time that anyone out there has a question, feel free to give me a call.
And what number would they call?
They can call a variety, but the easiest one to catch me is 864-923-2925, 864-923-2925. That's my cell phone.
Hey, how about that? He gave out his cell phone right here this morning. Thank you so much, Mike Pitts.
You're welcome.
All right. That'll do it for us. This is WCRS right here in Greenwood. News is almost over, and we'll listen to some music now. Bye-bye, everybody.